funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when loved ones can't make major life decisions for themselves, and is it possible to step in and help without worrying we have made the wrong choices? When mental illness, dementia, or intellectual disability render adults incapable of determining the course of their lives, family members are often responsible for assisting. But as my guest today understands firsthand and as a professional, choices about how and where those adults will live, what sort of care and medical treatment they need, and who will provide and pay for it can be excruciating for loved ones. Vicky Kind is a bioethicist and author of the new book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. Vicky, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm just delighted to be here. Thank you, Chris.
You write that this is the book that you wish had been available when your mom had a massive stroke when you were just 21 years old. Can you talk for a minute about some of the unexpected sorts of issues that you suddenly had to cope with on a daily basis?
Yes. About 25 years ago, I was 21 and still living at home, going to school, and my mom had a massive stroke. And I'm overwhelmed. I have a couple brothers that live nearby, but, you know, they're busy doing their lives. They're older, and all of a sudden, most of the responsibility is on me. And I have to now do everything for her because she becomes severely disabled. You know, I have to help her get dressed. I have to take her to all her appointments. I have to be in charge of her, and it's a terrible role reversal because, you know, I'm just 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a terrible position for anyone at any age, but I think what was really difficult for me and one of the things that was a catalyst in my life is that I couldn't communicate with the doctors. The doctors didn't understand that they were doing things to my mom and making decisions about how she should live her life in a way that wasn't what my mom would want. My mom had communicated her wishes. I knew what she would want, and they didn't even ask. And so my mom lived in a terrible condition for many years because the doctor said, you should live like this.
Hmm.
And that's not the way it's supposed to work. The way it works is that you're supposed to ask the patient if they're available, and if not, you ask the family, what would your mom say? What would your mom be telling us is the right thing to do for her? Because we're all different, and we want to be respected, our values, our culture, religion. You know, it was a really hard place to be in.
Now, for many families, the first step in making good decisions and making sure that family members have the right outcome is determining their capacity to have a say in those decisions, and that can be a tough prospect, particularly with those whose mental capacities have not always been impaired.
Right. And so I think one of the hardest things is when people are okay some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the hardest moments where, but someday she's better. In the morning she's okay, but in the afternoon she changes. Or I don't want to see the changes. One of the problems is the caregiver doesn't want their life to be as drastically changed as mine was, because you realize if they really are unable to think for themselves, I have to make the decisions. And so one of the tools that I use, the shared decision-making model and the sliding scale for decision, and these are tools that come from my profession in bioethics, these tools help us figure out what is the mental age of the person we're caring for. Because if you think about a child, you let a 14-year-old child do different things than you let a 2-year-old child.
Sure.
You know, and when I give examples like that, these tools actually come from pediatric medical ethics. And so they're tools we use to include and empower and give as much control to somebody who's not fully able, but we still have to step in.
What role does professional evaluation play in that determination? And what maybe could the experts help us to understand that might not be immediately apparent to us in the family?
You know, it's been interesting with me. I spend a lot of my time educating physicians. I do a lot of end-of-life work and teaching them how to be better communicators. And for them, a lot of times, they don't see the disability because people come into the office, and for some reason, they put on a good front.
Mm-hmm.
My dad would come in, and he would be just charming and telling delightful stories. And I'd leave there, and I'd be like, whose stories were they? They weren't even yours. But, you know, so sometimes the professional isn't on board. But what the professional can do is to make sure that if the person's mental capacity is slipping, is there something we can do to fix it?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people get what's called a urinary tract infection, and literally within a few days, it'll look like they have dementia, and they were just fine a couple days ago. This happens to people when they're older, and if you just give them the antibiotics, they come right back, you know, or they may be having a side effect to a new medication. And so you really want to partner with that doctor to see, is there anything else I can do to bring that person back? And if not, is there anything I can do to slow down the progression, such as in Alzheimer's, we have medicine that slows down the appearance of the symptoms. It doesn't actually stop the symptoms from growing kind of behind the scenes, but it slows it down from the day-to-day living. And then eventually the Alzheimer's is stronger than those medicines. But, you know, we want to give our loved ones a chance.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the UTI issue. We've had experience with this in my own extended family. And one thing we learned was that you have to tell the treating physicians that this is new behavior because they don't necessarily know that the person you're bringing in is not this way all the time.
Right. And I encourage people to write it down. There's something more credible to a doctor if something is written down than just spoken.
Mm-hmm.
They take it more seriously. So I would make two lists. One list of the behaviors that my loved one used to be able to do and the behaviors that they're now doing. So say they're starting to act out at home or getting aggressive or getting confused and lost. You know, 3 months ago, Dad was fine, but now he can't remember how to tie his shoes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you write it down, all of a sudden the doctor reads it and I don't know why. It should be just the same, but for some reason, it's taken more seriously.
Yeah. Well, talk about this, Vicki. When there are people who on a daily basis, as you mentioned, are fine in the morning and sort of sundown in the afternoons or have other issues, how do we accommodate sharing the power to make certain decisions with people based on their biorhythms?
Right. So the way I do it is I teach people this basic structure that we divide people into three categories. If they're mentally 0 to 6, which is very childlike, they're not even in school, they shouldn't be crossing a street by themselves,
mm-hmm.
0 to 6. 7 to 13, they're quite capable. You know, at 7, if people are 8, 9, they're choosing which sport they want to play. You know, 12-year-olds, they can stay home alone. And then 14 to 17. And so I ask people to think about, what can your loved one do, and how is that similar to the skills of somebody that's younger? So if you're not able to leave your loved one home alone at 12 because he's not safe, in the mornings he's not okay, he doesn't really perk up till later, that means he's less able. If he's doing quite well, we give him more power. And so as the mental ability fluctuates through these different ranges, you give the person more power and control and voice depending on where they are right then. So if my dad had vascular dementia, if he was mentally 12 on some days,
mm-hmm.
he was quite in charge of his life, you know? He wasn't going to sign a document to buy a car. He wasn't driving, but he certainly could decide which activities he wanted to do, what he was going to eat. You know, he was quite in charge. But on the days when he was having delusions and hallucinations, he was mentally like a 5-year-old. I had to step in. I had to protect him. So as the mental age changes, we look at how much power and control the person can have.
You share, this is a bit of a digression, but you share a poignant story in the book, Vicki, of going to see your dad, and he was having a delusional moment, and you knew that what he needed was for you to say, I'm here, and sort of go along with him because that would comfort him. And the staff at the facility where he was felt the need to sort of try and snap him back to reality, which wasn't going to happen anyway.
Right. I think a lot of times we want that person to still be the way they were, and we don't like to lie to people.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to treat them like babies. And I agree. I mean, these are fully grown people. But what we need to realize is this is a person with a disability, and we need to tend to them and comfort them and support them just like you would a small child. You know, we wouldn't yell at a 2-year-old for making a normal mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's just the way they are. And so my dad was really confused, and the instinct everyone has is to say, you know, you're being confused. Stop being confused. Well, good luck with that. Somebody's having a mental issue, whether it's mental illness or a dementia problem. You're not going to change where they are. And my dad was so frightened. He would get these terrible war delusions where he'd be back in the war. He needed to feel safe. He needed to feel protected. So I ask families to think about the experience that that patient or that person is going through from their experience. What does it feel like? And try to really step into that person's shoes and bring them comfort and support. You're not going to change a mental illness or a dementia problem. All you want to do is make their day-to-day living better.
In your experience, helping make decisions for those with limited but not absent mental capacity is often the most complicated. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so what I say to people is, now that you've got an idea of the mental age, the range that that person's in, you want to give them some power and voice, but you also have to consider, what type of situation is this? How dangerous is this situation, and should they be included? So if somebody, driving is a big example. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are afraid to take away the car keys. But we don't let people drive on, you know, in the middle of Dallas, we don't let people drive when they're 12.
Yeah.
But we do let 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds drive on farms. And the reason is because it's safer. You know, the tractors don't go very fast. There's not anything to hit. So people are allowed to do different things because of the danger involved and their mental age. So I was explaining this to a gentleman, and I asked him, after I've talked to him for a while, I asked him, well, what mental age do you think your dad is? And he said, 8.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and he literally, like, hit his head like, oh, like, aha, you know? And he said, 8-year-olds don't drive in the city.
Hmm.
My dad is 8. I have to take away the keys. And it was so comforting to him because he knew why. His gut had been saying, take away those keys, take away those keys, he's not safe. But he needed something to hold on to say, that's why my gut is right. And so that helps in those more dangerous situations. We must step in, we must protect people from, you know, not from dangers, things that are going to make them fall if they're not eating right. But if we want them to eat, we don't have to control what they're eating. You know, we can give people options. You know, a lot of times in nursing homes, everyone eats the same meal. Well, I doubt that all of us nowadays eat the same meal every day, right? I mean, we go to lunch at different times. We choose different foods. And so if we can bring some of that dignity and respect and say to that person, what are you hungry for? That's a decision anyone can make.
And you can sort of create decision opportunities that won't hurt someone necessarily if they make what you consider to be the wrong choice.
Perfect. Exactly. What you can do is a dear friend of mine, she has a relative with Alzheimer's, I think her sister, and she creates what she calls fake choices. But what she does is she has to take her sister to the doctors. So she doesn't say to the sister, do you want to go to the doctor? Because if you do that, what if she says no? Now you're stuck arguing with somebody with Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and that's not going to work. Instead, she says, we're going to the doctor. Which road do you want to take?
Hmm.
You want to take the back road and drive through the beautiful houses? Or you want to take the freeway and get there early and get a coffee? You know, so she allows her to have some choice and some control, but only in the little things that don't have a big impact.
Bioethicist and author Vicky Kind is with us. Her new book is called The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. We will resume our conversation in a moment, and you can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vicky Kind. She's a bioethicist and author of the new book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. She will address a senior circuit at Mirabella Assisted Living in Fort Worth on Wednesday, January 18th. She will also speak to the Dallas Area Agency on Aging on Friday, January 20th. The Dallas event is open to the public. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to go back for just a second, Vicky, to this question about taking the keys. This is not ever an easy decision for a senior or for the family members who begin to suspect that it is not safe for that senior to be driving. Have you found a good solution to this problem?
Well, the first thing I want to reassure families is that when you know it's time, you already know it's time. You really have to trust that when you're saying, I don't think he's safe, I don't think he's safe, it probably means he hasn't been safe for 3 months.
Uh-huh.
So you need to take action. Because it's so dangerous, that's the threshold in bioethics. When we consider medical treatments for people and make decisions for people who are vulnerable, what's the danger? And so we must take away the car keys. Now, you can take them for a senior driving evaluation. There are organizations that will take them for a road test and see how they're doing. So I think that's a fair thing to try, because especially if they're only a little bit confused. But the reality is driving is a very abstract thinking. You have to make a lot of judgments and decisions, and people can't once they start slipping. And so the family has to decide it's time. The best option is to get the physician to report them to the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and to ask for their driving privileges to be revoked. Most doctors are too chicken, and so they won't do that, which I feel badly, because that's a great thing for the doctor to do, so it's not on the family to do such a dreadful thing.
Yeah, it's almost like you'd rather compromise the doctor's relationship with the patient than the sons or daughters.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, how dare we take away our father's keys? You know, now on the AMA website, the American Medical Association website, there's actually a pamphlet to hand to the doctor. You can print it out saying how to take away the driving privileges. I would try at least with the doctor and see if you can convince them. If you don't want to do it, you can also privately, anonymously report the person to be retested at the Department of Motor Vehicles. There's usually a form online for a retest, and you fill it in and you explain why you think what you think. And you can submit that. I've actually submitted it for friends, parents, and spouses, because then they can always say, I didn't turn you in. Well, they called me and told me what to write, but they didn't turn it in, right? But I think the thing is, you've got to take away the keys. You're not allowed to take away the car, but you are able to disable it. And the thing is, the person who is losing their driving privileges is going to be mad and sad and full of strong emotions. And I don't know why, but we're uncomfortable when we see that person being mad. And so we try to shut that down. It's like, well, you know it's for your best. You know, it's like, no, let them be mad. Let them be upset. Don't back down because you've done the right thing. But stand there and say, you're right, Dad. You should be mad. This is a horrible day. I can't imagine what it will be like when it's my turn to lose my keys. What is this like for you? And let them vent. Let them get it out. And that's going to take days and days. You know, let them vent over and over again. You know, I remind women, you know, we don't just vent once. We vent to this girlfriend and that girlfriend, and then eventually, you know, it gets out. But you, number one, you must take them if you think it's time. Second, the person is entitled to their normal emotions. And you just have to just say, I'm sorry, but don't change your mind. And the third thing is you've got to, after a hard decision, we don't just leave the person suffering. We try to build a good life plan around them after this decision. So can their buddies still pick them up and bring them to their men's group meeting? Can someone from the church or synagogue come and get them so they can get to their faith services? Is there someone in the family who will drive them to the hardware store so they can just walk around and enjoy? You know, because people still need to get out. So if you're going to take away the keys, and you probably should if you're even thinking it, please create a way so this person still has a life. And there are private companies that will drive people and companion services. I know a lot of the geriatric care managers across the country, they have services like this, and they can set things up where they know the local resources, and they can come in and say, we can build a good plan in spite of your disability, in spite of these losses.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go on the phone now to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hey there. I am a healthcare professional, and I can speak to experience to a lot of what this topic is about today. And, you know, I get the opportunity to have a lot of conversations with patients that are capable at that point in their lives of making what, in all honesty, is an extremely simple decision in terms of the actual process. Making legal decisions, putting it down on paper as to what, you know, that patient wants done with them and how they need to be treated, you know, once they become incapacitated. In my own personal experience, it's been more at the end of life issues, which can become a lot more dramatic. And what's been interesting for me, though, is that the dynamic and the answers that I get in many cases as to why people are reluctant to go ahead and make these decisions for themselves when they're able has been changing somewhat. Years back, it was more about the fear of dealing with one's mortality, but also just their humanity, the fear of knowing that at a certain point, there's a very good possibility they will become incapacitated in terms of being able to make day-to-day decisions for themselves. But recently, though, when I have conversations about this issue, particularly with older patients, it really is swirling around the issue of politics and the fact that they're afraid that if they put something down on paper, even though they know that it's the best decision logically, they are starting to equate that with having someone else be in control.
Hmm.
Any experience with that at all or thoughts?
Yeah, you know, thank you so much. I really appreciate talking with you because end of life is where it gets really messy. And that's, as a bioethicist, that's where I sit with families in hospitals and navigate these difficult conversations. I think control is a huge issue. The two main things, developmental stages seniors go through at the end of their life are control and a need for legacy. One of the reasons seniors don't want you to boss them around and they don't want to feel pushed into decisions is they're trying to control their life still. Because they're starting to get out of control. Their health is failing, their eyesight's failing, and it's scary for them. So anything you do when you're talking with a senior is to try to have them be a partner, be the leader in these decisions. And I can see how that would go to politics, because if you've been a strong, independent person, you don't want to give away your control. None of us do. And I really haven't heard the political part of it, but it's also something that I don't usually bring up in those moments. So perhaps I'm having different conversations. The other issue of legacy, once the person feels like they still have some control, they still have some power in their life, they want to make sure that they mattered. And one of the best things you can do for seniors is to talk about how they'll be remembered, how they've made a difference in your life, what they've brought to your world. That is the greatest gift we can give people, and not in a morbid, dying kind of way, but just, you know what? I have learned so much from you. You know, you have been such a tremendous resource for me. Just hearing those words fills up that need for seniors. The other thing I find is that a lot of times the healthcare decisions, especially at the end of life, become about the body. And that's important, but it's really about what's meaningful. What's meaningful in the context of this person's life and their quality of life. When I explain that, well, you can go down this road medically, but there will be these certain physical sufferings, you won't be able to go and do these things, versus if you go down this road, you may not live as long, but you might have the strength still to go out and do that one more visit to visit the grandkids. People start changing their minds because you bring meaningful conversation about how the decision will play out in the life of this person. People make good decisions then.
Hmm. You know, the quality of life issue is really interesting because, as you point out, what works for one person doesn't work for another. One person may be really just eager to be out and be social. Another person wants to be able to spend more time in the garden. You can't define sort of on a broad basis what somebody really needs.
Right, and that's why you have to talk about it. You know, sometimes it becomes too late and we can't speak to that person because they're unconscious, they've had a stroke, they're brain injured, but we still know our loved ones. So, I bet everyone listening, if you thought about your spouse, your partner, and you're thinking, what would make his day wonderful? What would bring him joy and comfort and delight? We know. That's what we should be aiming for, is to bring a better quality of life to people even when they have disabilities. And it is different. I know people that will fight and medically take every treatment till their last breath. Now, most people look at that and they go, I don't want all that suffering because getting medical care doesn't feel good usually. Mm-hmm. I want to take another trip. And it's so personal. So that's why I encourage people to have these meaningful conversations, to write down not just what they want done to their body, but how they want to be cared for. Like, the simplest way to open up this conversation is to ask the person, when you're sick, do you want your feet under the covers or outside of the covers? Hmm. I mean, most people have a strong preference. I am a out-of-the-covers person. And I can imagine, you know, I'm in a nursing home, and every day the nurse comes by and tucks my feet in.
Yeah.
And I can't really move, maybe, because I don't feel well. That's going to drive me crazy. You know, mm-hmm. So you just start talking about, how do you want to be cared for? What would make a difference? Do you need prayers? Do you need certain rituals? Do you really want your family there, or don't you, because you can't stand them? You know, I mean, it goes both ways.
You have a tool in the book called the decision-making framework, which goes from autonomy to substituted judgment to the best interest standard. I think we all understand what autonomy means, that we afford to adults who are mentally capable the right to make their own decisions. Tell us about substituted judgment and how that comes into play.
Yeah, what I've been kind of doing today with you is I've been role-modeling substituted judgment. Substituted judgment means that when we're in the decision-making role, we're not supposed to use our values and choices. We're supposed to imagine what it would feel like and step into that person and think, what would he say? What would Bob be telling me if he could see the changes in his body? What would he be telling me about having to move to this facility? Is this the right one? Would he enjoy it? I know that when I was going to move my dad into a place that had care for people with dementia, you know, they were offering bingo and all sorts of things that he wasn't going to enjoy. You know, and so I was building a life plan for somebody, but I needed it to be right for their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's substituted judgment. It's not about us, because we don't live in that nursing home. We don't go through that surgery or through that chemo. I tell people, step into that person's life and speak with their voice. That's substituted judgment.
And below that, presenting its own perhaps more severe challenges, is what you call the best interest standard, which is essentially what any reasonable person would decide is best for someone. But, of course, we know that reasonable people can disagree.
Right. I mean, it's like, what's reasonable? You know, I ask people in audiences, who's reasonable here? Nobody ever raises their hand. You know, so that's what the law says. We should try to choose for others. If they are no longer able to speak for themselves, a good choice. Do something in their best interest. But again, it comes down to personal values. What I might think is in the best interest of this person who's disabled might be very different from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a tool we use in bioethics, and we use it for a couple different groups of people. We use it for people that have no family left. They don't have a lot of friends. Nobody comes to speak for them. And so we're kind of stuck, and we're like, I don't know. What do we do? We're going to do the best we can. Public guardians and private conservators, they use this tool because they don't know this person's values and beliefs. We also use this for people who have always been disabled. Some people are born with severe disabilities and never experience life in a way that they can tell us, this makes me happy or sad.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best interest standard says, I should do the best I can for this person thinking about it from their perspective, because they're living my choices. They live the consequences of my decisions. And the best way you can do this, really, is to do it in a group. Because if you and I and three other people sat together and really thought about how do we care for this person who's so ill right now, we would come up with a good plan. And it also takes it off the shoulders of just one person. But it's really difficult. It's not easy because you have nothing to go by. Think about the stranger walking down the street. You're now in charge of them.
Or they're in charge of you, for goodness sake.
That's even scarier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. See, this is why I tell people, write down what's important to you. On my website, I have a whole guide to filling out your advance directive and these meaningful wishes. And because you want to put it in writing. You want to put something in writing about who you are and what matters. Because you don't want some stranger to be making your decisions. Or you don't want your family member that you can't stand making your decisions for you.
Is there an age at which everyone, if they have not yet done so, ought to fill out an advance directive?
The legal age is 18, and that's for anyone who has mental capacity. Mm-hmm. So at 18, in my family, when the kids turn 18, they get handed an advance directive because you don't know what life will bring. I mean, people unfortunately get in car accidents. We have these young men going off to war coming back with brain injuries, in their early 20s, and their life has changed and completely altered because of their disability. So I encourage people to at least consider writing their wishes out. Now, what you might want when you're 18 and who you would pick to be your decision maker, that's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
An 18-year-old will probably have a parent still be in charge of them if they become disabled. When they get married, at 25, they're going to want their spouse to be in charge of them. And then what they want will change over the years. I did this form with a family. We actually sat together and had an advance directive party where we all... It was awesome mm-hmm. because everybody heard each other's wishes. People's eyes just were like, oh, that's what you would want?
Hmm.
I didn't know that. Really? And it was wonderful because it was safe. We did it together. It wasn't about, a lot of times the doctor walks in and says, fill this out. You're really old and dying.
Yeah.
Like, who wants to fill out the old and dying form?
My guest is bioethicist and author Vicky Kind. Her new book is called The Caregiver's Path, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. We will be back in just a moment. The number, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is bioethicist Vicky Kind. Her new book is called The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. Vicky will address a senior circuit event at Mirabella Assisted Living in Fort Worth on Wednesday, January 18th, and she'll speak to the Dallas Area on Aging on Friday, January 20th. That event is open to the public. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Vicky, you also touch in the book on something that troubles a lot of very well-meaning loved ones, and that is the reality that we can't always keep even promises made in good faith when circumstances change. For example, the sort of classic promise, I will never put you in a nursing home.
Oh, this is the one that tears people up. I mean, I've seen men who have made this promise, and they're good people, and they want to hold to it, but there's no way they can keep their loved one safe at home.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there comes a point where the needs of the person, whether it's the medical needs or the safety needs, become too much. To care for somebody 24 hours a day is really hard, and most people can't do it long term. It's just too difficult, and we have to make that hard decision. And so what I do is I talk with that person. I say, you know what, have you tried everything you can think of? Did you bring some home health caregivers in? Have you had your family take turns, different people coming in and you getting a break? You do all of the things you can to try to keep your promise. But there comes a point where the safety and health of that person is more than you can do. And that's when you can break your promise. You're not supposed to destroy your life for somebody else. Now, you'll still feel badly about breaking your promise. That is very true. You're going to feel badly, but you must. It's one of those times when, again, you must take change. And this is the question I ask. I say to that person, if she could see the changes and she could understand what it's doing to you, you're sitting here weeping, your health is falling apart, you're exhausted, would she forgive you for breaking this promise? Would she understand? And almost every time the person will say to me, yes, she would understand. She never imagined when I made that promise what that entailed. Because to be a full-time caregiver, you don't know until you're walking in those shoes.
Yeah.
And so it's okay to break the promise when it gets bad, and the person would forgive you because they never meant for you to suffer like that. That's not what people do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Bill in Mansfield. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Vicki, I wanted to thank you. Let me give you a short story. A few years ago, my best friend in the whole world was on death's door in Florida. I flew from Texas to see him before his demise, and several of his other buddies did as well from all over the country. He lived well over a year from that, and there was no way he could have made it. But what helped him, I just realized today, was we spoke of his legacy. And I know he was more comfortable, and he lived longer because of that. Thank you for letting me know that that's what it took.
Oh, Bill, you just made my heart so happy. Thank you. And thank you for being the kind of person who would get on that plane and go and say those important words. I mean, you are a true hero to me. Thank you, Bill.
Back to the phones now. The number 1-800-933-5372. Rosemary is on the line in Bedford. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello, yes. I'm calling because something was going through my mind. Wanted to make a comment regarding the elderly when they are more or less housed in some of the assisted livings or rehab places. I am a clinical social worker, so I have occasion to go to these and do some work with the elderly. But one of the things I think might be of use to people who come in, who are visitors, who come around, is if that individual who is, 87 years old and kind of shriveled in a wheelchair was able to have a picture of themselves attached, maybe as some pendant or to their chair or some way, so that the world could see they didn't start out 85 years old, that they had a previous connection to the world, and this is what they looked like. And it also might help each individual begin to realize more and more that time is just passing. And when we're not there today, if enough time passes, we're going to get to be 85 ourselves, 87, 92. And the more we can incorporate these individuals as people who've given so much to our communities and our families, I think it'll help us respect and love them and treat them more kindly.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about that, Vicki?
Oh, Rosemary is wonderful. First off, if you ever need help, a social worker is the person to turn to. They will go to the ends of the earth to find solutions for you. So, Rosemary, you are awesome. And I actually encourage people to do just what she said regarding putting a picture. And because when you move a loved one who can't really speak for themselves or they are no longer able to communicate, when you move them into an emergency room or into a new care facility, you have to teach the people there that this is a real person. This is not a body in the bed. This is not just a generic patient. This is a person who has meaning and joy. So what I encourage people to do is to go to like one of those dollar stores and get a 99-cent frame that's like an 8x10. Put a picture of the person. I like her idea of a younger picture, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to tell people, put a picture of them on a good day recently. So the healthcare provider knows that they're not always this sick,
yeah,
just like you mentioned with the UTI. And a picture of them in the past. And then in big writing, write down on the other half of the page things about who they are. They love chocolate ice cream. Their favorite show is Dancing with the Stars. They have 5 grandkids that they're proud of. Things about who they are and that they matter. So now when they come into a facility or an emergency room, they're not just a stranger. They're Mary, who has a favorite ice cream, who loved to jump rope when she was a little girl. And when you humanize a person like that, the people automatically start caring for them differently. So I'm a big fan of that. It's actually a something called person-centered care that we're really trying to implement into facilities and hospitals where the person counts. And I think it really does, I think it just improves everybody. Because I think even the nurses and the doctors, when they see that, it connects them to it. It reconnects their hearts.
And that also leads the conversation to something that you address in the book, which is that unfortunately people with diminished mental capacities are sometimes discriminated against in end-of-life care.
Yeah, I think this is one of my biggest motivators for writing the book and for doing the work I do, because when you become voiceless, you are relying on someone else to protect you and to build a good quality of life for you. And unfortunately, the good news is we have laws that protect people who are disabled. You know, we always feed people who are disabled. We protect them. We do all this care for them, whether they have an intellectual disability or a brain injury. We care for people. We don't abandon them. So that's a good part of our law. But we get in trouble at the end of life, because at the end of life, people start not eating. If you've ever been around somebody who's dying, they want a bite of ice cream. They don't want a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, and then eventually they don't even want that, because it's normal and natural as the body is shutting down to say, no more food, because the body doesn't need it. It's a very predictable and natural thing, and it makes the dying actually easier.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to die with a full stomach. It just isn't as comfortable. And so, unfortunately, we have to feed the disabled, but we forget that when they're in their last stages of the dying journey, we should stop trying to force food in them. We should be doing all the things that we would do to anybody and make sure that they have a comfortable and peaceful and meaningful dying experience. And oftentimes that doesn't happen. At the end of my aunt's life, she had multiple sclerosis, and she had done really well, and then at the very end, she really kind of crashed. And she wasn't eating. She was basically laying there unconscious, and they would still deliver her meal to her. You know, here, it's time to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and she would have choked even if they tried to put food in her.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense to me. I think people, especially the disabled, deserve to have a good end. And that means they should have grief support. They should have hospice care just like everybody else. Their body should be allowed to go through the natural dying journey. We have to not discriminate against them. We have to be able to say, enough, no more suffering, no more torturing this person because we think we know better. When somebody is dying, we have to listen to their body.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have on the line Mercedes in Dallas. Hi, Mercedes.
Hi. I'm listening to the comments, and you've covered just about everything I was going to speak on. However, medical directives I'm very familiar with. I'm in that situation myself. I experienced my mother's death. My youngest sibling, a sister, had power of attorney, and this had been in place for decades. And my mother liked to drive to the casino, and I would go with her on many occasions because I like to go to the casino, too.
Mm-hmm.
However, I stopped going with her because of her fierce objection to me telling her about the mistake she was making, such as driving on the curb for a block. And she did not want me to drive her. She had a car, and she purchased it recently. And she made it quite clear that the car was for our youngest sibling who had her power of attorney and made all of her decisions. And medical directives and all of that had been in place. And the nursing home choices were very questionable. I didn't have any decision-making in that choice.
Mercedes, I hate to rush you through this, but we're running out of time. I'm guessing that where you're leading here is people who both who care about your mother have different ideas about how to care
yes,
for her?
Yes, and okay. I was not a part of that. And be aware that things are going to change over a span of time. And
What can you say about that, Vicki?
You know what? It's absolutely true. You need to reevaluate. Is your caregiver, the person you're picking, still the right person?
Mm-hmm.
You should check that because sometimes people change. The other thing, and I'm not saying this happened in her experience, but there are people and family members who take advantage of the senior. And there's a lot of elder abuse and financial abuse and emotional abuse that's happening where one family member starts dominating that senior and taking the money and taking control. I would encourage people to reach out to the local area agency on aging. They're in every town in America, and there are experts waiting there to help you. If you're in that situation where you're like, this isn't right, they're making bad decisions, I think this is wrong, call and run it by them because we have to protect our seniors.
Are there resources, Vicki, for families in which the situation is not perhaps dire, but let's say a group of siblings can't agree on what's best for mom or dad?
Yeah, there are. I mentioned earlier something called geriatric care managers, and you got some great ones in your town. I know some of them. What they are very good at doing is navigating that whole family situation. They're able to do what's called like a elder mediation, where they sit and they help design a plan and redirect the focus to what the needs of the patient, that person is. There are people who are specialists in elder mediation. Mediation is a form of communicating and helping calm down conflicts. The area agency is also very good at, they have social workers and resources. And, you know, the thing is, the resources are out there now. You know, a lot of times what people will do is, like, I have a lot of families will actually buy my book and pass it around all the siblings. So they'll then all be on the same page working on this together. I mean, that doesn't always work because you sometimes have people that are really difficult in a family. You know, so I would reach out to a professional. So now the professional is coming in and saying, here's a good plan and helping calm down the situation. I personally would call a geriatric care manager.
Yeah, sometimes that neutral party is really will fix everything or can help fix things.
You can go to caremanager.org and you type in your zip code, and that's where you find local geriatric care managers.
Super. Vicki Kind is a bioethicist and author of the new book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. You can find her website at kindethics.com. She will be in town to address a senior circuit event at Mirabella Assisted Living in Fort Worth on Wednesday, January 18th, and she will speak to the Dallas area on aging on Friday, January 20th. That Dallas event is open to the public. Vicki, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's been wonderful.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.